May it please the court, counsel, good morning. My name is Charles X. I represent the United States in this appeal. The city of Chicago clearly had a property interest, not simply a regulatory interest, in this case. The district court, in its decision, properly rejected the defendant's claim that it was a purely regulatory interest. The court did rely on a Eighth Circuit case, the Granberry case, in finding that the defendants deprived the city of its right to control how its money can be spent. And there is no dispute that this right on a part of a party or a victim to control how its money is spent is the central focus of the mail fraud counts in what has been coined as the city scheme. I'd like to direct the court's attention to what was charged in the government's indictment. What was charged was a scheme, and it was also proved at trial, that the defendants participated in a scheme to defraud and to obtain money and property. And that money and property included the WBE MBE, which are the Women and Minority Business Enterprises. It included those MBE WBE contracts and subcontracts, which called for payments in excess of $100 million, as well as the funds actually paid pursuant to those contracts from the city of Chicago. That was the property interest that was alleged and was also proven by the evidence in this case. The city of Chicago passed an ordinance back, I believe, sometime around 1990, and it created the MBE-WBE set-aside program. And when it did that, it created a very important goal. And that goal, Your Honors, was to put 30% of all city contracts, 30% of all city contract dollars into the hands of these MBE and WBE businesses. The city, in passing this ordinance, was vitally interested in who got the benefits of these city contract dollars. In enacting that ordinance, there were very specific goals that the city of Chicago had in mind. One was that it made it a priority to hire and pay very specific intended recipients of city contracts. And those intended recipients, for 30% of the contract dollars, that being 25% for minorities, 5% for being women businesses, were targeted to be placed into the hands of those recipients. In creating this priority, the city of Chicago was not simply interested in obtaining the best price on its contracts by virtue of the lowest bidder. It certainly was not looking for the most experienced vendors or the most efficient vendors. That was part of the premise of the MBE-WBE program, was to get inexperienced minority and women businesses into city contracts to give them opportunities that they wouldn't otherwise have in a open bidding context.
Does that mean that the people who got this bid because they were experienced and more efficient had an opportunity to make a whole lot more money than would the city would have anticipated with what you describe as inexperienced and less, I guess, qualified people?
Well, let me put it to you this way, Your Honor. I think that if the city didn't have this program and just had open bidding, yes, more experienced, more efficient, higher economies of scale. We're talking about in many cases, for Windy City maintenance, at least custodial services. There certainly could have been many larger, more efficient contractors out there that could give a better price than a smaller, less experienced minority or women business enterprise that didn't have the same experience.
So the city's paying a considerably larger amount of money in order to employ or to get these WMBs and MBEs going.
Your Honor, I think that that is a consequence, yes, of the ordinance. And the city was willing to pay these premiums, if you will, to these MBE, WBE contractors in order to foster their growth and to permit them to earn a profit that they would otherwise not have access to on a purely open bidding system.
You're asserting, in structuring your argument this way, what the defendants are calling a purely regulatory interest. I don't know why you're just not arguing that we gave them money and money is in the statute and they weren't entitled to it because of the deception, and so it falls outside of the line of cases, McNally and Cleveland, et cetera.
We are arguing that, Your Honor.
Well, you haven't so far today.
I'm sorry, Your Honor. I will address that as I was about to get to that. There was certainly an economic and pecuniary injury, and I think that if you look at the cases, first of all, I think the defendants were focusing purely on this obtaining of the certification, and it goes far beyond that. The property interest here was also the misuse of that status to obtain $100 million of the city's money. And there is, first I'd like to direct the court's attention to a case that we cite, U.S. versus Bush. It's a Seventh Circuit opinion authored by Judge Bauer. And I would submit that that case itself stands for the proposition that when city contract officials are deprived of their right to bargain with all material and relevant facts, that constitutes a pecuniary injury, not some pie-in-the-sky, uncalculable or zero injury. That was a case where I would submit also dealt with a direct deprivation of a city's right to dispose or contract of its money. One of the keys to this right to control the spending of money is whether the deprivation of the right, that information was material and relevant to the bargain. In other words, was it important in making the decision of how to dispose of the money? And you are right, Judge Sykes, that you cannot take the eye off the fact of that $100 million is a very tangible interest. I know Mr. Scheer gave an example, and I would submit that if you were to analyze the type of injury that was suffered here, one could look at an example of if I were to send a $100 check to my brother for his birthday each year, and I sent it certified mail, and my brother were to go and pick it up at the mail post office, but before he was able to get to the post office, an imposter got there first, posing as my brother, and took the money, diverted it. I would submit that that is a clear injury. I never intended for that imposter to obtain the $100 that I had sent to my brother. That is a calculable, pecuniary, certain harm. That
That's
is not
perplexing. You know, how did these imposters get in so easily? Weren't there a number of minority businesses already known? Maybe they weren't efficient or whatever. that would have been more logical people? And when you see these people come along, they didn't even know them, and they get this $100 million contract.
Well, Your Honor, as far as waste management is concerned, and REM, there was a very close friend of Jim Duff's, a unindicted co-conspirator that was responsible for arranging with Jim Duff when Jim Duff said to Jim Berry, was the official, we need to have a MBE as part of our contract. The city requires that we have 25% of all of our contract dollars go to an MBE. And there, Jim Duff stepped up and said, I can get you a MBE certified company.
So the city didn't even have a list of approved MBEs and WBEs, huh?
Well, it may have had a list of MBE, WBEs, but no contractor is, you know, required to have to go simply to the list. And because what happened here, and which was part of the scheme, was that REM wasn't on that list. Jim Duff, as part of the scheme, put co-defendant Stratton as what is clearly admitted as a minority front, clear deception of the city, and went through the certification process, got certified, and was able to become the subcontractor to obtain these proceeds. So as far as REM is concerned, which is of the $100 million, probably, I believe, over 70 of that went to REM, which was basically certified for the express purpose of deceiving and ripping off the city. Now, there are other cases that are also supporting the proposition that the city of Chicago's payment to the contractors that were MBEs and or WBEs, as well as the subcontractors, constitute this right to control the spending of its money. And in the Second Circuit, I would submit, as we have cited, the U.S. versus Biagi case, which where the Second Circuit, in a case involving a Section 8 program for disadvantaged business enterprises, which functioned exactly the same as the city's set-aside program, that the Second Circuit rejected the very same argument that there were no property rights and held that the Department of Defense was deprived of its right to control its property when the defendants, just exactly as they did here, brought in a front minority. And I would also just submit there were other cases that we have cited, the DeMone case, the Kinney case, which all talk about this particular concept that where there is valuable material information which the victim is deprived of in deciding how to use or control one's assets, that is a deprivation of a property interest. Here, what was the essential material information that was deprived of the city? Very clear. To be allowed to pay a true MBE WBE. That information couldn't have been any more important, couldn't have been any more essential, couldn't have been any more material to the city in its contracting.
Counsel, that's the object. That's not the object of the fraud. That's the fraud. The object of the fraud here was the money. And
right.
To go back to my earlier question, I really don't understand the line of argument that your opponents are advancing or that you are addressing here, which is this idea of a pecuniary injury or harm, which is not what McNally and Cleveland require. They require that the object of the fraud be money or property or a property interest, and that's all. The necessity for some sort of harm or injury is a civil fraud requirement, not a criminal fraud requirement.
Well, that's correct. But
the fraud and deceit here has to do with the phony MBE certifications, but the object of the fraud was the city's money, and that's all the further you need to go, it seems to me. Is that I mean, is that not the essence of your argument, even though that's not what you're essentially advancing here today?
Well, I'm sorry if I'm not making my point clear, but that is what I am advancing, is that that property interest is ultimately the money. It is the obtaining of the contracts, which goes to this concept of the right to control your property interest, and the money that they received. It absolutely is. It absolutely is, Your Honors. I apologize if I have not made that point clear enough. But I simply want to make this point, that the fraud by the defendants was depriving the city of its right to ensure that that money, the $100 million, got into the hands of the proper recipients, those recipients being the WBE and the MBE, true WBE and MBE contractors. In essence, the defendants here were the imposters. They had no right to that money, and they stepped in there and by fraud and deceit obtained monies that they never should have been entitled to receive. It was important to the city that that money, that $100 million.
If I could redirect you at this point onto Mr. Leahy's case.
Sure.
What's the government's best evidence against him? The very best you have.
Your Honor, what it comes down to is the background of his first involvement in the case went to 1982, and that's when Windy City Labor Service first started operating, started providing its temporary manpower services. Mr. Leahy was the insurance representative at that time. He signed that very first application. In that application, Windy City Labor Service was very specifically described as a temporary service for labor-type work, providing various type of labor-type jobs, including janitorial work, truck helpers, warehousemen, and bottling.
Was there something false about that?
No, that is true.
So the one he did sign is true?
So when the business starts, when he is there in 82, and there's no dispute that he's been a long-time insurance agent for the Duffs, he knows exactly what they're doing and what type of work with these truck helpers, warehousemen, housing, and bottling. Principally, their clients were liquor distributors such as Judge and Dolph, Pacific Wine, other large distributors whose warehouses, basically, they took these temporary helpers to help load trucks.
Is there any evidence that Mr. Leahy saw any of the subsequent insurance applications that were allegedly, not allegedly, I guess they absolutely were false because they contained the certifications about the clerical employment, which was not consistent with the actual employment history of the company?
Well, what ends up happening is that as part of the insurance agency's duties, and Mr. Wisniewski didn't come into the picture till 89, Mr. Leahy was on this account starting in 1982. He was the owner, the president of the company. There were things called certificates of insurance for clients. That's to verify that Windy City Labor had proper insurance and turned it over to the clients. So Mr. Leahy knew who, or should have known, who all these clients were because they were periodically coming asking for these certificates. And he had to know, should have known, that they were all liquor distributors. That as the fraud was progressing, bogus lists were provided to the insurance companies of clients, sent to the insurance authorities.
By Mr. Leahy?
By Wisniewski, who was working for him, that were filled with Duff associates that were clearly there to deceive the insurance companies.
And what is the evidence that Mr. Leahy saw those documents?
Well, direct evidence that he viewed them all. We don't have
circumstantial evidence.
Right.
Well, any evidence.
Right. Well, the circumstantial evidence, starting in, as I said, it starts in 1982. He knows what the nature of it is. He sees these certificates of insurance. He knows who the
There isn't anything fraudulent about the certificates of insurance.
No.
Okay.
It is saying who the true clients are, in contrast to who are the clients that are being told by his direct subordinate as to who the clients are to the insurance companies that are receiving the applications.
I'm sorry. I'm not following you.
Okay. These the certificates of insurance are proof to Windy City's clients that they have insurance.
Right.
And so,
and you just told me there was nothing fraudulent about those.
Correct. But what was fraudulent at the same time that these certificates of insurance are being issued by Leahy and Associates, Wisniewski is transmitting to the insurance companies who the applications are going to the names of completely false clients.
What None is the evidence that Mr. Leahy knew about that?
Well, what is the part of the direct evidence?
Circumstantial evidence.
Right.
Any evidence.
Right. This is what I'm trying to get to. That he, first of all, that he was known to be a very hands-on person, and the evidence was clear that he would look at all the paperwork that
What evidence was clearly establishing that? Just that, this sort of overarching idea that he was a hands-on manager?
It was one of his only employee that testified at the trial as to what kind of boss he was.
And what did she say about his receipt of documents?
She said that he received...
This is Gomez, right?
Yes.
Maribel Gomez.
Copies of all the paperwork that was sent out on customer accounts.
She testified specifically to that, that he saw every piece of paper that went out of that agency?
She testified that he received copies of all the paperwork that was sent out. That's what she testified
okay.
to, that he was very hands-on, that he knew what was going on with his agents, that he knew what was going on with all of his customer accounts, and that he was familiar with all of the issues on all of his accounts, including specifically the Duff account.
Did she work there the whole time, 1982?
She certainly was not there from 1982, and I cannot...
When she show up?
I can't cite the exact date that she started working there. I do know that she was an employee of Leahy far earlier than 1999, which is what Mr. Padale was saying was when she started working in this specific commercial part of the office. But I believe that she had worked there for a number of years, certainly during a significant portion of the time that the scheme was operating.
When is the first time that Leahy was, there's no question, that he participated in preparing submissions for insurance? I think it was casualty.
Correct, 1982.
Yeah, but that was the first one. But I mean, as far as who blew the whistle? Was it casualty? I started losing
no,
track.
No, casualty. No, no. Who actually blew the whistle was...
Who started complaining about, say, wait a minute, these are guys that are dropping stuff on their feet. They aren't clerical.
Kemper, farther, many years later, around 1998, was the first one that actually blew the whistle based on all the information that they had seen. But what also was happening, and relating to the fact that Leahy was a very hands-on owner and was looking at the paperwork that was both coming in and going out on his client accounts, was that during Casualty, who was the first insurer of Windy City Labor Service for workers' comp, in 1985 is when the numbers really started drastically changing. That's when the deception started to occur, and the numbers started flipping from going from a purely labor-based payroll to becoming a predominantly clerical. And all of these types of annual audit and renewal premium reports, they would list all of the payroll classifications, all of that paperwork, undisputed. It's in the record. It's on all those documents, CC to Leahy and Associates. Leahy was, at that period of time, during Casualty, in those earliest years, he was the one that was getting it.
So there's documentary evidence that he was copied?
Yes.
On the documents that demonstrate the disconnect between the premiums?
Yes.
And the loss history?
Absolutely.
Okay.
And with that, and as well, of these annual audit and renewal premium reports were the experience modifiers, which were going up and up and up as the classification was being misclassified.
And when did the disconnect first manifest itself, and then the documentary evidence?
About 1985, which was actually before the period that we even alleged in the indictment, which was starting in 89.
And the documentary evidence that shows he was CC'd on these documents
this
covers what time period?
From 1982, when they first, when Windy City Labor Service first becomes a client, all the way through the end of the scheme. Every year, the insurance agents for Windy City would receive these annual audit and renewal premium reports, and those reports always would show what the payroll classifications were.
And the documents show that the audit went to Leahy and not just Wisniewski.
Yes, absolutely.
Okay.
It's right on there. They would also receive injury reports that would always show that it was a warehousing injury, never anything that would be consistent with a classification of a clerical worker type workforce. Those injury reports and what they call lost runs were always sent from the insurance carriers to Leahy and Associates. That also, as far as a paper trail is concerned, was documentary evidence that was put into evidence during the trial that showed that as well. Leahy files also, which show the CC to Leahy, well documented the long history of audit reports, threats of cancellation, all the way through the 80s and into the 90s. I cannot stress enough the fact that Mr. Leahy was a frequent visitor to the offices of Windy City Labor Service. This was not some fancy office building that clearly would be servicing a clerical or white-collar type of business.
What was the testimony of your expert regarding the interpretation of those audit reports? Was there testimony from him that this would have been obvious?
Yes, it was clear that there was a misclassification. There were also lay witnesses, other insurance agents that were at or assurance auditors that testified that they had great suspicion that this was misclassified. In 1999, one of the brokers that Leahy himself went to when they were going from the involuntary market to the voluntary market because they were being threatened to be canceled in the involuntary market, as soon as he got the history and saw the payroll classification and the modifier, which was all the way up past 3.0, which is a huge red flag that there is some problem. He said to Ed Wisniewski right then and there, this is just totally wrong. This is a misclassification. Get the correct numbers, and we'll see if we can get insurance for you. And Wisniewski then says to him, okay, I got to talk to Leahy. And then Leahy, then after they get it, an insurance company on the voluntary market, they find one who will bind the insurance. Leahy calls and says to Braband how outrageous the amount of premium is. That clearly was another indication. That's by 1999, Your Honor. I mean, that just shows a continuation of his involvement.
Can I ask you, what was the point of offering the conversation between Leahy and Adrian Heigl, the city employee from the controller's office? Was that offered specifically as 404B?
It was, but it was first offered as being part of the crime. What Mr. Leahy, although he was only charged as part of the insurance scheme, he was also an unindicted co-conspirator in the city scheme. We had filed a Santiago proffer that laid this entire lie out, and we attempted to get it admitted as a co-conspirator statement. And Judge Bucklow ultimately admitted it as 404B because Mr. Leahy was not actually indicted as a formal conspirator. She put us basically to the test of having to get it in through an alternative means, although we believe that the record clearly establishes that it should have come in just as a co-conspirator statement, period, without having to go to 404B. But we did below establish it alternatively as 404B, and we met all of the tests of under the 404B of similarity. It was not used for propensity. It was used to show his knowledge and intent, and it's clear that it was a lie. It was. I would strongly disagree that the record clearly supports that everything that he said to the city was a lie, and it was done for just one purpose, and that was to put money in the pockets of his co-conspirator, James Duff.
Could I ask one question, just one clarification?
Sure.
This is just a quick thing. On restitution for Duff and Stratton, was that $10 million?
That was $10.9 million, yes.
Was there also a forfeiture?
There was. Yes.
What amount?
I believe it was of a similar amount.
Is that redundant?
It is redundant in the sense that it is based on a similar figure.
Is it the same money?
It's not intended to go to the same money. The restitution is intended to go to the victim to make the victim whole, whereas the forfeited money is intended more as a punishment to just divest the criminal of their criminal proceeds. So
it's intentionally a total of $20
million. Yes. So it's not the same money. The money that he would pay for forfeiture would be different than the money that would go to the city as a restitution victim. Thank you very much.
Thank you, counsel. You have a minute, sir.
Your Honors, I hope to make 3 points very quickly. The first point of which is Mr. X gave you a hypothetical that to me illustrates that the government fails to understand what mail fraud is. That letter of $100 that was stolen, that was a theft case. That wasn't a mail fraud case. The presence of deceit and money in the same case does not equal a mail fraud case. And if the right to control the expenditure of money was sufficient for purposes of mail fraud, then McNally and Cleveland and Mittelstadt and Ashman and Walters are all wrongly decided. The universities didn't want to do business with those athletes, and the traders didn't, or the customers didn't want to do business with those traders, and had they known the full truth, they wouldn't have, but that doesn't mean that it's mail fraud. The second thing I'd like to say, Your Honors, is that I don't believe either today in argument or at any point in the briefs the government has ever shown any basis to resist the irresistible conclusion that Mr. Duff's sentence was calculated in an erroneous manner and that it is far more harsh than what the law permits. And his sentence absolutely is an injustice and an incorrect application of the guidelines that must be vacated. And third, Judge Mannion, what could be a more vivid illustration of the error that permeates this case than to know that restitution in the amount of $10 million has been ordered to the city, and that money constitutes pure windfall. The city got for what it paid. The city was provided everything it was entitled to. The $10 million as restitution is so illogical, it shows how many errors permeate this case. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel. I believe Mr. Pennelly has one minute if you wish to take it.
Judge, I can only ask you in reviewing this record to remember that John Leahy is John Leahy. He's not Leahy and Associates, the corporation. They didn't indict the corporation. All those carbon copies say are producer copy. That means they went to the corporation, which had hundreds of clients.
Is that what the CC reflects, that it was copied to Leahy and Associates? Or
they say producer's copy, and the producer means the broker. They don't show John Leahy carbon copied. There's not a one of them that indicates that. And so please, with respect to that evidence, Judge, the fact is there's none that says Mr. Leahy saw those reports. Thank you very much.
Thank you, counsel. Thanks to all counsel, and the case will be taken under advisement.